Welcome to the Gardening in the Mountains Home Gardening Show with Steve Pettis. Steve is your Henderson County agent with NC State University, here to talk gardening, answer your questions, and help you make your garden grow better. Call the Extension Office at 697-4891 or email Steve at gardeninginthemountains@gmail.com to have your gardening questions answered. That's 697-4891 or email Steve at gardeninginthemountains@gmail.com.
Brought to you by A Growing Concern, celebrating 39 years. Bring life and color to your outdoor and indoor space with the professionals at A Growing Concern, Spartanburg Highway.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Gardening in the Mountains radio show and podcast. I'm Steve Pettis, your local county extension agent and host. We're here to talk gardening, answer your garden questions, and help you make your garden grow better. You can email me at gardeninginthemountains@gmail.com or give me a call at the extension office, 697-4891, 697-4891, and I'll answer all your gardening questions. Been getting tons of emails lately with people sending me stuff about the yards. There's all kinds of problems. There's always problems in the landscape. The drought is really contributing a lot to plant stress and plants having to readjust. So what will happen is in the year prior, so this is 26, back in 2025, a lot of trees and shrubs and plants set buds for this year based on how good last year was. You know, so let's say last year was a really great year, lots of rain, great weather, it might put a lot of buds on. And then all those buds will germinate in the spring of 2026. Well, you may end up with a drought like we have right now. And so if that's the case, then trees will make the rational choice to eliminate some of those leaves that they had put on from last year. So you can expect to start seeing some leaf drop and things like that if this drought continues as it does appear to be doing. So that's not only deciduous trees. What you'll find is you'll just start finding a tree might drop 5% of its leaves, maybe even 10%, according to how long this goes on. And it kind of worries people. People think the tree's dying, but, you know, plants can live through unbelievable droughts and cold snaps and all the other things. So they're pretty resilient. It's us that gets upset about it when we see a tree dropping leaves and things. So it happens to deciduous trees, but it also happens to conifers as well. So what prompted me to want to talk about this is I've gotten lots of emails about conifers dropping needles, turning brown, dropping needles. And in several cases, they were plants that were planted within the last 2 years. So say some arborvitae somebody planted along the road at their home to block off or screen the street and the street noise. Well, just because that plant's been in the ground for 2 years doesn't mean it's totally established, especially if it was a field-grown tree that was dug out of a field, meaning most of its roots were cut off. It could take that tree up to 5 years to really kind of fully recover and put on all the roots it needs. So as long as it's water in the soil, plants can do fine with a diminished root system. But once it starts getting dry like it is right now, those plants start exhibiting drought symptoms. And I literally have had three or four emails with pictures of plants, such as especially arborvitaes, because they're so popular right now, totally turning brown, and the person automatically thinks it's a disease. It's just drought. So you do want to get out and water your plants. And, you know, it's not as simple as, you know, might think. You don't drag a garden hose around and stand over a plant for 5 seconds and then move on to the next one, especially larger plants. You need to really soak the ground, because if you think about how much water comes down in a rain event, that it's a tremendous amount of water if you just measure it in gallons. So I think 1 inch of water over an acre. So say if you get 1 inch rain and it rains that over an acre, that's like more water than is in a swimming pool. So, you know, many tens of thousands of gallons of water. And the soil acts as a sponge, almost. It absorbs soil and stores it. So we consider that water, the soil water. And plants have what they call the permanent wilting point. And this is when a plant is wilted so far that it actually starts to die. So that's what you want to avoid. And you do that by watering thoroughly. And when I say water thoroughly, I mean, for instance, I've got a couple of trees I've planted in the last couple of years, and I give those things multiple gallons of water every time I water. Now, how often do I water? I water twice a week right now. I'm watering my semi-established plants. I haven't started watering my really established plants yet, so like azaleas that have been there forever and that sort of thing. But if the drought continues, I will start watering those plants just to I don't want them to get all stressed out and get diseases or azalea lace bug or whatever it is that happens to your plants when they get stressed. So stressed plants get sick, just like humans when they get stressed. So preventing drought stress is super important to keep your plants healthy. So when you want to irrigate, it's often wise to invest in some sort of, especially for a tree, let's say they have these things called gator bags. So it's just a watering device. It's a big, it's basically a sack made out of sort of the same material that a tarp is made out of. And I guess the weave in it is such that it leaks a little water. So you fill this thing up with, say, 20, 30 gallons of water, and slowly over a period of days, it weeps this water out of this bag, soaking the ground, slowly watering the plant, but like putting all of that water deep into the soil. So that's a lot different than standing next to a plant with a garden hose for 5 seconds. The soil may look wet when you finish, but the penetration that you got down deep into the soil is not much. And so if you have to water a plant over and over and over again, let's say for a whole season because it's really dry, and all you do is irrigate the surface of the soil, what you'll cause to happen is plants will congregate their roots in the top, very close to the surface of the soil, because that's where the water is. And that can predispose that plant to suffer drought in the future because it doesn't have deep roots. So this happens in turf when people have irrigation systems and they don't have the irrigation system running enough because they get their water bill and they're like, whoa, okay, I'm not going to cut back on my water on my lawn. And that causes the lawn because you're not watering very deeply, you're just sprinkling over the top, causes the roots to end all up at the top of the soil. And the plant doesn't have the access to the deep soil where the water is stored. That's what roots do, is roots dive down into the soil and they try to go down as far as they can. And roots get inhibited by, in the southeast anyway, by soil compaction. You know, soil's pretty compacted. If you've dug a hole in your yard, you know how hard the ground is. Now imagine being a root. So if you notice when you're digging a hole, the first few inches are pretty easy. That's because that soil tends to be more loose. It's where the roots are. The roots have broken it up. There's earthworms and other creatures in that soil, aerating it, loosening up the soil particles. But you dig a little further down and you get to the red clay, the subsoil, then it's a whole other story. That soil is super hard. It's also very acidic. So roots, when they go down, one, they can't penetrate that hard red clay easily. The other thing is it's basically toxic to the root, so the root dies. And then so what you end up with is your roots are on the surface. They're in the top 6 inches, 8 inches of soil. Even on big giant trees, you don't get roots that go straight down in the ground. Any tree that blows over in a storm, you see it pulls the root plate up. There's no roots going down. They're all going horizontal. So and we can fix that. We can loosen up the soil down at depth, especially when you're planting a tree. You can dig a hole deep and then backfill it so that you give the plant some loose soil there it can send a root down into. But the fact is most of the roots are going to end up on the surface because that's where the water is. So when you water thoroughly, and I do recommend you water at least once a week very thoroughly all your trees and shrubs that you really care about. The larger trees, they can hack it. They can just shut down, you know, a large oak, a large pine. They'll just shut down and quit growing and stop using water. A big mature oak can transpire, which means evaporate water out of its leaves, up to 100 gallons a day. So imagine how much water you'd have to put on, say, a big mature oak just to give it enough water to compensate for the daily water use that the tree has. So what you'll see with conifers in drought is you'll see the lower limbs starting to dry first often, and it works its way up. So keep an eye out for that. Make sure you water anything that's been planted in the last couple years. Water everything you really care about because this is turning out to be pretty dry weather. I did a little reading this week. One of my topics I've been talking about a lot lately is creating mixed species hedges and plantings on hillsides and things. So the idea is, rather than using a monoculture in either one of those situations, so when I say monoculture, it means one plant. We want to plant multiple kinds of plants. So people want to plant a hedge, and they put, you know, 50 Leland cypress in a row, or 50 arborvitaes in a row, or 50 hollies, or 50 cherry laurels. And those can work for a while, but invariably, inevitably, and without an exception, every plant we've ever done that with starts to get diseases and die. Because once we planted millions and millions and millions of them in the landscape, and they're all clonal, meaning they're exactly alike, any disease or insects that can affect them will affect them, and it will start to wipe them out. And that's starting to happen with a lot of plants. Cherry laurels, which is your autolucums and your skips and those others, are starting to fall apart. Just drive around. Everywhere you go, you see them with dead limbs in them. Same with Leland cypress. Arborvitaes are starting to get that way. So I'm trying to encourage people to plant mixed hedges. In my reading I was doing earlier, they referred to it as a thicket. And that's a good way to think about it. People kind of understand what a thicket is. A thicket is a dense planting of mixed various species, all growing up in a tangle. That, you know, when I was a kid, every fence row had a thicket on it. So nobody sprayed the weeds off their fences. Nobody controlled weeds on fences. You just had a fence and it had a big thicket around it. And that actually was a host for a lot of wildlife back in the day. When I was a kid, we had quail that would come out of there every day out into the cornfield from the thickets along the edge of the field. So trying to replicate that is a great alternative to planting a monoculture hedge between you and your neighbor. So what does this mean? This means planting various types of trees and shrubs. You don't want to plant anything over about 20 feet, because usually if it's 20 foot tall or more, it's going to become a tree. So you won't, it'll just be a trunk and you won't have your screening ability for that planting. If the plants grow too tall and don't have any leaves there to block the view. The idea is that you plant the thicket slash hedgerow slash mixed hedge, whatever you want to call it. You plant that thing thick enough that even in the wintertime, when the deciduous trees lose their leaves, it's still providing you a screen between you and your neighbor. And when we get back from this break, I'm going to talk more about planting a mixed planting using various mostly native species, here on the Gardening in the Mountains radio show and podcast.
This is Duke from the Growing Concern Nursery and Garden Center, and we're proud to be celebrating 40 years rooted in this community, beautifying landscapes since 1986. Spring is upon us, and our inventory is arriving daily. Flowering trees like dogwoods, redbuds, crabapples, plums, serviceberry, fringe trees, magnolias, and more. Favorite shrubs of the region like azaleas, rhododendron, mountain laurel, pyrus, viburnum, just to name a few. So come on into Hendersonville's oldest garden center, a Growing Concern on Spartanburg Highway, celebrating 40 years.
At the local table restaurant, fresh and local isn't a trend. It's the foundation. Many of the seasonal ingredients you'll enjoy are grown right at Stump Farms, bringing true farm-to-table flavor straight to your plate. From breakfast served all day to creative lunches and new light bites in the evening, everything is made from scratch and thoughtfully prepared. The local table is a place to gather with friends and family. Discover what's happening now and what's coming next at thelocaltablehendo.com.
Turn your garden into a buzzing, blooming haven. Raymond's Garden Center is your go-to for pollinator-friendly plants that bring bees, butterflies, and beauty to your yard.
Plant something that gives back this season. Come to Raymond's Garden Center, 1320 Canoga Road.
Welcome back to the Gardening in the Mountains radio show and podcast. I'm Steve Pettis, local county extension agent and host. Thank you for listening. This is show number 276. Hard to believe we're approaching 300 shows here on the Gardening in the Mountains radio show and podcast. Been getting lots of calls about hornets. Not lots, but enough to mention it. People are seeing the native cicada killer hornet. The cicada killer hornet is a scarily large hornet. It's a big wasp. It's about the size of your pinky in size. Imagine your pinky with wings. That's about how big a cicada killer is. And they're pretty formidable looking. They're actually quite harmless. They can sting you, but they rarely do. They're busy gathering up their food source, which the name implies, right? Cicada killer. They eat cicadas. And if you know what a cicada is, that's that big aphid-like creature that makes all the racket in the tops of the trees in the summertime. So that's what this insect does. This insect, a female, individual female, she bores a hole into the ground about the size of a quarter. So if you see holes in your ground about the size of a quarter, but they don't go straight down, they go almost at like a shallow angle down into the ground. And there's like a, the soil that's been removed that made like a, makes like a little landing strip in front of that hole. That's a cicada killer hole, because what the female does, she lays an egg in there and then she goes and stings cicadas. So to immobilize them, brings them back and shoves them down in that hole for her larvae to eat. While they're still alive, which is fascinating. But this wasp is solitary. She lives alone. She doesn't have, there's not thousands of them in the hole in the ground where it's just her and whatever eggs and larvae she may be brooding. But when you see one of these things bumping around your screens on your porch or banging on your window or whatever, it can be disturbing. And you might think it was some alien creature, some invasive creature. We do have some invasive hornets that have been found in the country. The most famous one was the notorious Japanese hornet, aka the murder hornet. That thing came along during COVID. Nobody had anything to do except get worried about murder hornets, and it was a big deal. It was, people got all freaked out, and I literally would field 25 to 30 calls about that a week. There for weeks and weeks and weeks and months. People called about that. In fact, it was so frequent, I had a separate list that I would keep just to try to keep up with how many people were calling about it. Luckily, that was one nest, and way out in the Pacific Northwest, the USDA took care of that. Hopefully, those things don't come back, and we won't see those. Another insect that has been found in the Southeast lately is called the yellow-legged hornet, and it. Visually, it's difficult to identify, separate from a lot of other hornets. So we have European hornets, which have been here forever. They're invasive, but they've been here so long they're naturalized in the environment. They probably came over in the holds of the big sailing ships, wooden sailing ships back in the day. That's how long they've been here. So the yellow-legged hornet is a new one. It looks similar. The difference is its nest is about, I don't know, 10 times bigger than a regular hornet's nest. I mean, the pictures I've seen of the one they found in South Carolina was huge. I mean, this thing was as big as a person. I mean, a small person anyway. A huge, huge nest. So that is something we're worried about. They have found those in Georgia. They found them in South Carolina. And it's probably just a matter of time before they find them here. They're trying to find the nest. So if somebody sees one, they try to go track the nest down and kill it before it goes reproductive and starts making babies. But obviously they're not finding every one because there's just too many places in the world where they can hide in the forests and things. So that is one that you got to worry about. But the murder hornet is not one you need to worry about. I've gotten multiple emails in the last couple of weeks about this topic. And I am pretty sure it's what people are probably seeing is the very intimidating and large cicada killer hornet, which is an individual female. She doesn't have like a clan of warriors in a nest somewhere that will come and kill you. She's out there just trying to harvest insects and feed them to her babies. So I'm always happy to try to identify any insect that you find that you suspect may be that may be suspect. I'm happy to look at them. But I'm pleased to say that right now we don't have those murder hornets here in Western North Carolina. Thank goodness. Back to what I was talking about earlier, which was mixed plantings. In the landscape architecture world, this kind of a planting is called a pocket planting or a pocket forest. And what people have been doing this forever, even Frederick Law Olmsted, the guy who did Central Park, he did the landscape at the Biltmore House. He did tons of famous landscapes Olmsted did. And what he would do was he would take these sites that were usually cut over or cleared or whatever, and he's trying to make a park out of it. So he wanted some forest. So he would plant the area that he wanted to be a forest. He wouldn't just put a tree over here and then 10 feet over there put a tree and 20 feet over there put a tree. He put these things, packed them, and they're super tight. Just like what happened naturally. What would happen naturally if, say, you cleared a forest and then you just walked away. All the seeds in the ground are going to germinate. There's going to be tree seeds and weed seeds and grass seeds. All that's going to come up, and it will create a thicket that would be impenetrable. You wouldn't be able to walk through it. It'll be so thick. And so that's what landscape architects have been doing forever in these plantings we call pocket forests. And I personally have observed one planting of a pocket forest back when I was in college, and this shows you how old I am. Back in the 90s, I remember them planting this landscape, pocket forest landscape, on the campus of the University of Georgia on a new development that they were building. There was a whole bunch of buildings. It's big, many, many, many acres, this place. And so in the in-between places, they planted pocket forests. And they did it from relatively small trees, maybe 6-foot trees, down to potted plants also. And I saw this not too long ago, the same area, and now these trees are all like 50 feet tall. The diameter of some of the pines and oaks are in the 20-inch diameter, and it's a complete forest. And when they first planted it, it was so thick, people were like, what the heck are they doing? But, nature sorts itself out, and the fittest survive. And when you plant those plants super dense like that, that's what they do. The plants compete. Vigorously, and the toughest ones will survive, and you create what's essentially a native planting, just like Mother Nature would do. And we can do this in our own landscape. We don't need to do it. We don't have to have acres to do it. We can do it in little small pockets. So if you have a little area and you're interested in turning it into native planting, plant it thick with natives plants. The same way with a hillside. So you got a hillside that's got soil eroding, and you want to stabilize it. The best thing to do is plant tons of plants on it, and then whatever ground is left, you cover with mulch. So, some plants. Let's talk plants. People love when I talk plants because they like to hear what plants I recommend. So I'm going to go through a list real quick of these are Steve's favorite plants for Western North Carolina. Serviceberry, Amelanchier arborea. I love that plant. It's a multi-stem shrub. Has fruit on it. Not too big. It's 25 feet or less. Red buds, dogwoods, fringe trees. I love fringe trees. Carolina silverbells. Saw one of these recently that was really beautiful. It had tons of flowers on it, etc. There's lots of other small trees that are deciduous to our area that you can use in landscapes and gardens. And then evergreen native trees. So we have our native red cedars, arborvitae, American hollies. And then there's Savannah and Foster holly, which are they're hybrids between the American and the Chinese holly. But these hollies are really good. They're really great for the landscape. So don't be afraid to plant those. They're not invasive or anything. Then we have the smaller southern magnolia cultivars that like Little Jim and Bracken's Brown Beauty and all those that are smaller. And then shrubs. Let's talk about shrubs. So larger shrubs. We have things like sumac and arrowwood viburnum. That's a beautiful multi-stem shrub. Bottlebrush buckeye. Oakleaf hydrangea, which I've mentioned before, is one of my favorites. Ninebark. Ninebark's a beautiful plant with purple leaves and purple stems, exfoliating bark, multi-stem shrub. And then if you move down a notch to what we consider to be mid-sized shrubs, it's things would be like sweet shrub and red twig dogwood and Hearts of Bustin, which is our native euonymus plant, and Fothergilla, Hypericum, which is a really great plant. Winterberry, I mention it all the time, is my top plants. I love that one because it has red berries on it in the winter. And then, of course, if you have shade, you got to switch gears, do some other plants, mountain laurels, rhododendron, inkberry. Things like that will work there. And then we have lots of grasses, blue stem, big and little blue stems, broom sedge, river oats, switchgrass, muley grass, love grass. There's a whole list of native plants on my website you can look up. And then plants that cover some ground. So we, like I said before, we don't like the word ground cover anymore because basically if it's a ground cover, it's invasive. So we want to avoid invasives. But what we do want to do is cover the ground with plants. So we do that by planting lots of things such as yellow root or green and gold or wild ginger or native Pachysandra or native phlox, goes on and on. And then, of course, tons of wildflowers native to Western North Carolina. You can order wildflower seeds if you have a big area to cover. You can buy wildflower seeds from the Eden Brothers website or American Meadows websites. I love those two websites for ordering southeastern native seed mixes. They also sell native grasses on American Meadows is more native centric than even Eden Brothers is. So check that out. Black-eyed Susans, coneflowers, milkweeds, asters, Baptisia, which is false indigo, Coreopsis, and Joe Pieweed. My Joe Pieweeds are about 6 feet tall right now, looking great. Carolina geranium, swamp sunflowers, bee balms, Carolina phlox, cardinal flower, mountain mint, which is probably the best out of all of them as far as attracting pollinators. Mountain mint has actually been studied and proven to be the best, most attractive shrub that you can plant for pollinators. And with that, I'm out of time. So get out there, water your plants. It is droughty. It is very dry. There's not a lot of rain in the forecast. So if you value any planting in your landscape, I suggest you get out there and irrigate them thoroughly. Thanks for listening. Have a great week and happy gardening, everyone.
This has been Gardening in the Mountains with Steve Pettis. Steve is your Henderson County agent with NC State University. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, call the Henderson County Extension Office at 697-4891 or email Steve at gardeninginthemountains@gmail.com. That's 697-4891 or email Steve at gardeninginthemountains@gmail.com. To listen to this show again or hear past episodes, go to WTZQ.com. Click on the Features tab and scroll down to Gardening in the Mountains.
Brought to you by A Growing Concern, celebrating 39 years. Bring life and color to your outdoor and indoor space with the professionals at A Growing Concern, Spartanburg Highway.